Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. Fear. Why does it so often prevent leaders and congregations from taking action? In this episode, Lewis Center Associate Director Ann Michael speaks with Reverend Adam Hamilton, author of the new book, Unafraid, Living with Courage and Hope in Uncertain Times, about how people of faith can move beyond the paralysis of fear.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary, and I'm also the editor of Leading Ideas e-newsletter. And I'm talking today with Reverend Adam Hamilton, the pastor of the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection. And I think for most of our listeners, Adam needs no introduction. He is the founding pastor of Church of the Resurrection, which has grown to be the largest church in our denomination. And he's the author of so many books and resources that have been a help to individual Christians, but also to church leaders. And his most recent book is Unafraid, Living with Courage and Hope in Uncertain Times. So we're so fortunate to be talking with Adam today. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you, Anne. It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, so let me begin by asking you this question. What led you to take on the subject of fear? Because this is a book about the human emotion of fear and how we cope with it.
Yeah, so part of it, it really emerged in 2016. And as I look back over my ministry, you know, over and over I've addressed fear in my ministry and preaching. That's just a regular part of life. It's a part of the human condition. But in 2016, I noticed a couple of things. I noticed that fear was rising to a really high level in our society. This was happening during the presidential election season, and both the politics around Congress, but also around the presidency, were eliciting fear. A lot of the rhetoric was eliciting fear. And so I was feeling this, but then when I began to research this, I found that Americans were more fearful in 2016 than they had been at any time since just after 9/11. And I thought, so, okay, this is not just me feeling this and the congregation that I serve. This is across the country. That plus conversations I was having with people, like one fellow in particular, a friend who told me about a job, you know, career change that he'd made. And he'd left a job that was pretty safe and secure, took another job where he was working out of New York City. And he was telling me how he was walking down the street, down Broadway one day in New York City. And all of a sudden he was overcome with fear. He said, I had a panic attack, thinking I had just left a safe and secure job. I have a wife and two kids to take care of. And here I am, and I'm not sure if I'm going to make it or not make it in this new career. And I'm just, he said, I was overwhelmed with fear, and I'm surrounded by hundreds of thousands of people walking by. And he said, in the middle of my panic attack, what struck me was, I bet all of these people are afraid too sometimes. And he said, somehow that helped me to know that everybody else is also afraid. And as we had that conversation, I thought, you know, both on a national or societal level, as well as on an individual basis, we wrestle with fear. And so out of that, I thought the idea of the book emerged, and I thought, well, I want to test these ideas out first as a sermon series. And so in January of 2017, I preached a series based on the initial research that I'd done. And then out of that sermon series, and I found it seemed to be really helpful to our congregation, I spent another 9 months working on the book and really adding flesh to the outline of those sermons.
Mm-hmm. So for the benefit of our listeners, I'll just share that the book is organized in terms of some of the different kinds of fears that people typically experience. So you write about fear of crime and terrorism and fear of failure and fear of change and fear of death and dying and so forth. And I would imagine that for people who are in pastoral ministry, these are a lot of the day-to-day concerns that real people are dealing with. In some ways, it's kind of a compendium, I think, of the existential anxieties that most Americans experience. And I think in a lot of parts of the book, one of the subtexts that I sort of picked up on is the idea that a lot of times our fears are disproportionate to the actual risk that's realistic in terms of what people's actual exposure is to harm. Why do you think that is? Why do you think that our fears sometimes take on an outsized dimension?
Sure. Well, I might start by just saying that fear is a good thing, that it's a gift from God. The fact that we have a part of our brain called the amygdala, two actually portions of our brain, one in each hemisphere, that are designed to deal with possible threats to our existence. And so, you know, this produces the fight or flight mechanism that is what keeps us alive. We are around today on this planet because God gave us the gift of being able to respond to potential threats. So that's a really good thing. Then we have this other cognitive side. So the amygdala works at a subconscious level. I mean, instantaneously, before you can even process a possible threat, if it sees something flying at you, you know, it kicks into gear. You immediately duck. You've got your muscles are tensing up. Your breathing becomes more shallow and more rapid. Your heart beats faster. This is all that fight or flight mechanism. You also have this cognitive side that is responsible for how we respond to fear. And so this is where you learn fear. You have experiences throughout your life that teach you. You know, you had an experience when you were a child and you realized it was a potential threat to you. And for the rest of your life, that memory is etched in your memory banks that, hey, stay away from that or be aware of that because, you know, something bad happened to somebody else or you because of this particular possible threat. Then we add information to our brains that help us, you know, process, okay, we learn along the way things that are possible threats to us. So we have all of this cognitive information that's within us. And then we add to that the imagination. And the imagination is an amazing gift from God that allows us to, you know, we imagine possible threats, even though we've had no personal experience with them and no one's told us, but we can imagine what that might be. The challenge with our imagination and with our memory and the data that we put into our brains is that sometimes we misconstrue the facts, we maybe misunderstand, maybe the severity of the threat has been painted much larger than it really is. And so we imagine threats to be bigger than they really are. And I use the analogy in the book of, you know, in your rearview mirror, passenger side rearview mirror, you can see in your car a little statement that says, objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. Well, it works just the opposite with our imagination. And that is objects in our mirror, what we're thinking about in our imagination, are appearing closer than they actually are. They're actually further away than they appear. So we outsize or we make things into much larger threats. We talk about that as making mountains out of molehills, you know, and it's hard for us sometimes to differentiate between how serious a threat this thing really is. And sometimes it is a threat, but we allow that to paralyze us. So one of the chapters in the book, one of the illustrations is the Israelites who send 12 spies into the land of Egypt. They come back and they say, 10 of them say, you know, these people are too dangerous for us. The cities are fortified. We look like grasshoppers in their eyes. And the other two say, no, we can do it. We can do it. Well, they spend 38 years, the next 38 years, paralyzed a mile from the promised land because they've given into their fears. And their fears are undoubtedly exaggerated. In the end, they certainly were able to conquer the Israel, you know, the Canaanites. But it's interesting how fear all the way back to biblical times has paralyzed us and how we tend to see, you know, so those spies saw the others as giants and we look like grasshoppers. That's really how it works in our lives. We see these threats as giants and we seem like grasshoppers in the light of them.
Yeah, I definitely did take that message away from the reading of the book that so often things aren't as bad as we imagine them to be. But I guess one of the thoughts that led me to was, you know, what is your message to someone who has a legitimate, well-grounded reason to be fearful? Something like a battered spouse who's caught in an abusive marriage, or an immigrant who fears that they're going to be deported and separated from their children, or, you know, soldiers on the battlefield. I mean, someone who is living in a state of just constant, chronic, real fear.
So I want to use one word to describe what we were talking about before and then address this. The word that's used in clinical therapy for imagining things that are worse than they really are is called catastrophizing. And I love the word because we tend to catastrophize things. We turn things, you know, that might be a minimal threat into a major catastrophe. But what you're describing is very real. You know, there are real threats that we have. And if you're going into battle, those are real threats. If you're dealing with an abusive spouse, those are real threats. So fear is meant to move us to action. And in the book, I lay out these four steps that human beings have always used to deal with their fears. And what happens is fear can paralyze us when there is a real threat as well. And so instead of acting, we find ourselves stuck. And that is often the case when it comes to an abusive spouse. It can be the case in a whole host of other areas where fear is meant to move us to action. So if you have a legitimate fear and you don't act upon it, then you're going to continue to wrestle with the fear. So one of the steps is attacking your anxieties with action. And so as another example, you know, there are people who have fears related to finances, and they're very legitimate fears. The ship is sinking, or they don't have enough for retirement, and they're anxious about that. In fact, that's one of the top fears for those over 50 in the survey that we did, was not having enough finances for retirement. Well, you can be fearful about that and do nothing, take no action, and you're going to continue to live with that chronic fear. Or you can allow that fear to motivate you to action. And when you take action, you find the fear begins to dissipate because you're actually doing something. You're proactively taking steps to address whatever the fear is. There's other steps, though, that are involved, too. Part of it has to do with analyzing or assessing the real facts behind the fear. So a lot of things that we're fearful of, we maybe should be fearful of them, but we want to find out, you know, what is the magnitude of the fear, of the real threat, and then what are some things that we can do to address it? So again, attacking your anxieties with action. For the person who's living with somebody who is an abuser, that means taking steps to get out of the abusive relationships. Easier said than done, but going to meet with somebody, taking that first step is really important in being able to address the thing that we're fearful of.
Thank you. That's helpful in response to that. I want to ask a different question about the overall approach to the book. It's not an explicitly religious book. It does bring in faith and scriptures, but it kind of brings them in alongside. And it's published by a secular publishing house. And so I'm assuming that your goal here is to reach a larger audience. And I wanted to know what your hope was in coming at the subject this way, and also how you think other church leaders might use a book like this that's not written in explicitly religious language.
Right. So one of the passions that I have and that Church of the Resurrection has is reaching non-religious and nominally religious people. And so the question is, how do we go about doing that? And one of the ways we do that is by talking about the things that we universally struggle with. So fear is one of the fundamental forces at work in us as human beings. It's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So the book, you know, my thinking on the book was to write a book that everyone would find, yes, I need this. You know, anybody who's wrestling with fear, they would be willing to pick it up. In the book, I mentioned, faith winds its way through all of the chapters, but the idea was, let's write this in a way that somebody who is non-religious is not immediately put off and saying, oh, gosh, this is only for those religious people. It's not for me. And in that, it's kind of a model for how I do much of my preaching and how I think we as pastors and church leaders need to think about doing ministry in an increasingly secular age. We've got to figure out, how do we connect with those non-religious and nominally religious people? So for me, you know, naming the issues and the fears, being able to help everybody at a universal, you know, level identify with various things that are found in the book, doing really great research. And then underneath that, you know, I don't hide the fact that I'm a Christian pastor, that, you know, I share illustrations from the congregation. And then, you know, as you dig deeper and deeper, you get towards the end of the book. And by the end of the book, we talk about releasing our cares to God. And I just lay out for folks, you know, long before we had Xanax and Zoloft, medications to help us deal with fear, we had prayer. Human beings turn to God. And then I talk about, what does faith look like? And faith is putting your imagination to work, the same imagination that imagines threats that may or may not be real, or maybe imagines them bigger than they really are. Put that imagination to work to imagine that there is a God who holds you, who walks with you, who will never leave you or forsake you. And throughout the book, I teach certain spiritual practices that most of your listeners know about, but I talk about Lectio Divina and what does that look like, and talk about journaling and talking about, you know, breath prayers. And in the end of the book, there's an appendix with 31 daily scripture readings to invite people to mold these scriptures over. But, you know, to put this in sort of a terms that I was on a secular program recently, and you know, I knew they were a little cautious about the talking about the releasing your fears to God part. And I said, let me just give you an example. And that's Dr. Martin Luther King. And you know, everybody can relate to Dr. King. And so I said, you know, at one point when he was leading the Montgomery bus boycott, he receives a phone call in the middle of the night threatening to kill him and his family. And he gets off the phone, he's sitting in the kitchen, and he's really scared. And he begins to pray. And he says, God, I'm really scared. I don't think I can do this anymore. And he hears this voice welling up saying, you know, continue to preach justice, continue to stand up for righteousness. And it was that moment of prayer and the response he got that led him to continue to lead the civil rights movement. And where would we be had he not stopped to pray? And so the same thing is true for all of us. And if I can put that in terms that a secular person can go, oh, that kind of makes sense. And then I can say, and, you know, if you use your imagination, Dr. King's favorite hymn, you know, gospel hymn was Precious Lord, Take My Hand. You can use your imagination to imagine all kinds of scary things that are out there, but you can also use your imagination to imagine a God who's holding your hand and walking with you through the valley of the shadow of death, and that brings you peace. And that's what Hebrews is talking about when it says faith is the evidence of things hoped for and the substance of things not seen. And so, in the book, it's let's deal with the human condition. And then in the process in there, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, gosh, if we just pray, if we just practice the spiritual disciplines, we won't have fear. I lay out three steps that we take to addressing our fears that don't specifically focus on faith. But the fourth one is, you know, this is really important. And together, these four work to help us live unafraid. So I did the same thing in the sermon series. You know, it was what we call a fishing expedition sermon series. I preached it right after Christmas Eve candlelight, and we announced it on Christmas Eve candlelight, and we said, you know, this is where we're going next. And we found there were people who came out who are non-religious people, came to church just because they wanted to have some help in dealing with their fears. So my hope was that churches would take this, and the book is published by Convergent, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. But the supplemental materials are published by Abingdon. So there's a leader's guide with five videos that we do. I'm sitting with a group of pastors. And then finally, I'm interviewing key leaders and neuroscientists from Vanderbilt. I'm interviewing Bishop Will Williman is on one of the interviews, a Fortune 100 CEO, my wife who struggled with panic and anxiety, and a family counselor. And so those videos are designed to be used in small groups, and there's a leader's guide, and there's a children's component and a youth component, so that churches might work together at addressing, you know, fear that would pastorally help everyone in the congregation and at the same time be an outreach for the community, for people who don't think they have an interest in faith, but they do have an interest in learning how to conquer their fears.
Yeah, thank you. And I did mean to mention that, yes, the book does come with companion resources that bring it into the realm of the life of faith more fully. Let me see if I could take this in a little bit different direction. And knowing that you've done all this work and thinking about fear, the book itself really deals with the realm of individual personal fears that people experience at a personal level. But since our beat here at the Lewis Center is congregational life and church leadership, I wondered if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about if you've thought at all about this element of fear within the institutional life of a church and how fear plays itself out in church life and how church leaders might deal with that in light of what you've learned about fear.
Sure. So one of the things, there's several components to that. I think, first of all, when we become fearful, and fear can be, you know, almost all of these fears that I talk about as individuals also work and relate to entities, organizations, including congregations. So I think about this idea of fear keeping us from doing the things that keeping us from taking risks. So almost every great experience in our lives requires a measure of risk-taking. I think about choosing to get married, choosing to have children. When LaVon and I went to start Church of the Resurrection in 1990, I use this as an illustration in the book. I had a number of key leaders in the Missouri West Annual Conference who said, Adam, it's underfunded, it's undercapitalized, it's never going to work. You really shouldn't do this. You know, you're going to end up failing, and you'll be a pastor of a 4-point charge after that. And so I use this as an illustration of how fear can take hold and keep us from taking risks. And in the end, you know, I decided, well, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? I'll serve a 4-point charge if this doesn't work. But I think God is calling me to do it. And I describe in the book something I've taught on leadership across the country. And this is the principle of discernment by nausea, that often there's a fork in the road for congregations and for individuals. And when there's a fork in the road, there's one path that's easy and safe and it doesn't take a lot of risk taking. And then the other path that we might take is hard and difficult and it feels riskier and it makes us sick to our stomach. And that's the nausea. And discernment by nausea says that when there's those two paths, usually the path that makes us a little sick to our stomach is the right path. It leads to the greatest reward. It's the path that leads to the most, you know, greatest impact. And I've seen that over and over and over again at Church of the Resurrection and leading the congregation, is that you know, the best things that happened at resurrection happened despite our fears and because we pressed through our fears. And that led us to, you know, see amazing things as a result. And so, you know, and there's a quote I have in here that I've shared again across the country. Successful people, it came out of a Franklin Time Management course I once took, but successful people are willing to do the things unsuccessful people are unwilling to do. And however you define success, it's just so simple, but you know, most of us end up being paralyzed by our fears and we don't do the things that would have actually led to our greatest, you know, greatest success. For local churches, that may mean, you know, the community has moved to the other side of the highway and we need to look at giving up our building and moving somewhere else. It may mean starting programs that we're a little afraid. What if they don't succeed? I mean, I remember when we started our preschool and you know, I was kind of nervous because it required resources and we didn't have a whole lot at the time. And we started it and we only had like 4 children register. And I thought, oh, this is a disaster. You know, but today we have a waiting list and we have, you know, we have hundreds of kids who have been through this, thousands have been through this program. So that risk taking is one example. I also think we're afraid sometimes to talk about issues about which we're divided. And we live in a very polarized time where the far right and the far left have sort of set the agendas for everyone else. And we are, most of us as Methodists in particular, we're people of via media, the middle way in which we, you know, we're able to deal with the, you know, ambiguity. We're able to deal with the gray in the world and to deal with the fact that, you know, we might both be, you know, people on the left and the right might both be Christians and we have different ways of reading the text. Well, I find, you know, today, sometimes we're afraid to talk about issues, whether it's guns and gun violence or refugees or immigrants or, you know, sexuality or whatever, because we know we have people in different places. And I think we've got to figure out how do we not give into the fear of not talking about these things, but instead, how do we talk about them with wisdom and recognizing that people are in different places and helping people hear the people on both sides. Maybe our job isn't to come down always on here's the place where you need to be, but instead helping people understand the claims, the legitimate concerns of people on both sides of a particular issue.
So what would your advice be to a leader that found themselves in the midst of a situation where a congregation needed to embrace a healthier level of risk or was dealing with a difficult polarizing issue and wanted to be able to lead the congregation through those fears? You know, how do you... inviting them to nausea doesn't sound like a very appealing way, but what do you say?
Well, I do think teaching people that idea of discernment by nausea, and you know, Jesus talked about there being two paths, one that's wide and broad and leads to destruction, and one that's narrow and hard and it leads to life. And so I think people, we need to be able to teach our people the importance of risk taking. Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, that's one component. And you can paint that out throughout, you know, you look at that throughout scripture and see how the biblical people were able to take risks. But I think when it comes to dealing with controversial issues, one of the things that I have tried to do throughout my ministry is a certain way of preaching into those issues. And sometimes you don't need to preach into them. Sometimes you need to organize a study outside of the, you know, outside of Sunday mornings. So there are events we have, like we have a forum that's going to be coming up on guns in the congregation. We're going to bring people together on both sides and to try to listen to the concerns on both sides and to say, okay, how could we find a solution? What might be the solution to the concerns we have, legitimate concerns we have about guns today, that's a real and helpful solution and not something that just makes us feel better and that both sides might be able to come together on. So we've done that a number of times where we've had forums to talk about controversial issues instead of trying to talk about it in worship on Sunday mornings. There are other times where preaching into it can be very helpful. So we did a series of sermons in 2017 or 2016, I don't remember which, on the issue, 2016. It was the issues we knew were coming up in the election that were divisive. And I did a SurveyMonkey survey and I invited the congregation, you know, here's 20 possible divisive issues. Which ones are you most interested in, you know, as we go into the election? And we took the top 5. And so, you know, one of those was guns. When it came to guns, you know, part of what alienates people is if they feel like you make a statement, you teach something, and you didn't take the time to understand where they were coming from, or you didn't articulate their legitimate concerns. And so what I try to do on that is I interviewed people on both sides. We showed video with the folks on both sides sharing, you know, their particular perspectives. And then after doing that and laying out, okay, you know, here are these different places, let's see if we can find some common ground between them. And I was able to articulate that in a way based upon a certain reading of scripture that I think people walked away going, you know what? That was really helpful, actually. I see that we people on both sides actually agree about these five things that we could do in response. And this is how our faith plays some role in that. And so I find when we can do that, as opposed to standing up on our, you know, on our high horse and, you know, just preaching one side of an issue and alienating the portion of our congregation that's on the other side, that just makes people mad and leaves people leaving. But if we can actually understand the issues from both sides and then offer with humility, okay, here's where I come out based on this reading of scripture. And I think people respect that and they come away saying that was really helpful. And more often than not, when I preach on these kind of ethical issues, I have people say, I was really helped by that because you helped me see things I hadn't thought of before in the light of my faith.
Well, that's really helpful, I think, especially in light of how you began this conversation. I was very struck when you described how your sense that this heightened sense of fear that people have been feeling recently does come from the political anxiety and the political tensions that so characterize our society right now. Maybe to start drawing this to a conclusion, let me ask this question. If it is the case that we're in a particularly anxious time in our nation, in the world, I would say that's the consequence of the particular point in history in which we find ourselves. What's the word of hope as we find our way forward in an anxious time?
Well, first of all, I might say that what people most need in a time of anxiety is a non-anxious leader. And so the more anxious we are and we convey our anxieties from the pulpit, excuse me, or the other places that we lead, the more our people feel anxiety. Sometimes, if you're in a group of people, I was asked this question recently, what do I do when I'm in a group of friends and they're being anxious and maybe we don't need to be quite so anxious? I mentioned when one person is anxious in a group and they articulate that, you start finding that their anxiety spreads. I mean, it's just amazing how quickly other people become anxious from one person's anxiety. But it works just the opposite too. Sometimes one person is saying, you know, folks, I know that this seems scary, but here are the reasons why I'm not afraid, really plays a key role in tamping down fear. And I think, you know, part of the challenge is during the presidential election season, we had people who were, you know, running for office who were raising fears as opposed to helping people ask, are these legitimate fears and what are we going to do to act upon them as opposed to simply making people afraid. So I think part of what we have to be able to do is as a not sort of non-anxious presence from the pulpit to be able to say, and I said this right after the election in 2017, you know, I had people, you know, some people obviously were quite happy, but there were other folks who were more anxious. And I said, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid because for these reasons that I walked through, you know, I'm not afraid because we have checks and balances that are really important. I'm not afraid because America survived interesting people in the presidency before. I'm not afraid because ultimately we vote people in and out of office. But I'm also not afraid because I believe that God actually walks with us on this journey and that there are enough of us who are people of faith who are going to stand up for those who can't speak up for themselves. And because I believe that, you know, in the end, God's kingdom is bigger than any one particular political party or particular election and what happens in that. And I also am hopeful that, you know, for those who are fearful of the president, I'm hopeful that, you know, there will be enough people surrounding him that will help him rise to the occasion. And whatever it was I said, it was aimed at trying to help the people who were most afraid at that moment know that they're, as their pastor, I was not afraid. And I didn't think they had to be afraid as well. So I would say that's a key part of it is our conveying our own non-anxious presence and helping not give false reassurances, but instead to say, here are the things that I'm focused on in the face of this fear. Yeah, ultimately, the book, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say that seems like a wonderful opportunity, not just for individual leader, individual person in the pulpit, but for the church at large to be a witness to that kind of awareness and hope in this day. It seems like it's bigger than any one person. It seems like it's an opportunity that the whole church can embrace.
I think that's right, Anne. And when you look at the scripture, so I may have mentioned this already, but 400 times fear is mentioned in the Bible, fear or terror, but 140 times we're told, don't be afraid. And almost always that's followed by these words, for I am with you. And that idea, I think, is really important for us as people of faith, the idea that God is with us. And if God is with us, you know, I think about on all, you know, the trajectory of history and the horrible things that have happened throughout history. And it's not that God makes those things not happen or instantaneously fixes them, but the arc of history is always moving towards this idea of God, you know, of injustice being defeated by justice, of goodness triumphing over evil, of light conquering or being, you know, overcoming darkness. That's the broad trajectory. And so, you know, I count on that. And I think that's one of the things, you know, we as people of faith have to offer the world. You know, I love Buechner's quote, and I use it in the book, you know, the worst thing is never the last thing. And in particular, in the light of Easter, the worst thing is never the last thing. There's always hope. And no matter what happens, you know, God is still God. And so the last chapter in the book is on one fear we're meant to cultivate, and that is the fear of the Lord. And when I talk about that, you know, often we wonder, well, what does that really mean? Are we supposed to be terrified of God? And the answer is no, but we're meant to recognize how big God is and how small we are. And that should make us, you know, I think about Moses who fell to his knees, or the disciples when Jesus was in the boat and he calmed the storm and they immediately fell down and they were afraid. They were afraid because they'd seen a power that was so great they couldn't hardly comprehend it. And when we cultivate the fear of the Lord, it somehow has a way, you know, this idea of the greatness of God and the bigness of God and the power of God, it somehow has a way of tamping down the rest of our fears and putting them in perspective. And I think that's, you know, so helping people know how they release their cares to God. This is the fourth R in that acronym I have for fear, of how we deal with fears. Releasing our fears to God is something we also have to teach people. And that is how to practice the spiritual disciplines in a way, how to be able to trust, how to use your imagination to imagine that God is walking with you. And that addresses, you know, our fears individually, but as a congregation, we have a chance to bear witness in the community that we're people who are acting. We don't necessarily agree with whatever's happening in our world, but we're going to be people who take action. And in taking action, we find our fears begin to dissipate. That's another one of the letters in the acronym for fear, attacking your anxiety with action. We are going to be people who trust that God is going to be with us, and we're going to do everything we can to help the world be the kind of world it needs to be.
Amen. Adam, to conclude this, we often ask the people that we're interviewing for Leading Ideas Talks two questions. So let me pose them to you. So what are you reading right now, Adam?
Sure. Well, most recently I've been reading, I'm sitting here at my desk looking at 25 books on fear that are scaring me. From when I was working on this book. So that consumed a lot of my spare reading time. And of course, I'm always reading related to my sermons. So I have four commentaries that I've been reading through on the Gospel of Mark as I was preaching through Mark this season. Scott McKnight recently came to our church and spoke just a week ago. And he wrote the book Jesus Creed and several other books. But one of his books is on the kingdom of God. And it's not in front of me right now. I just started it this week. But I started reading that as a way of sort of seeing what he was saying about this. Scott is a professor at Northern Theological Seminary and an Anglican deacon. And I've appreciated his insights as well. So I just started reading one of his books. And then following Easter, I'm not really sure what I'll be reading after that, but there's always something, usually two or three books that I'm looking at any given
time. I was hoping maybe there was a pile of books on another subject that was going to be a clue to what you are going to be working on next. But
well, actually, I will tell you that I am. I'm working this summer, July, I'll be finishing a book on Simon Peter. And I'm actually really excited about this, looking at the life of Simon Peter, what we learn from him. He's a flawed yet faithful disciple, and he's a foil in the Gospels, where you look at Simon Peter and you're always seeing him pressed up against Jesus, and he blows it again and again and again, and yet you also see somebody who, despite blowing it, remains faithful. And so I was in the Holy Land about a month ago, and I was filming the small group videos for this book that's coming out in December through Abingdon, and then I'll be finishing the book in July. And I've had really a great deal of fun reading and pondering and thinking about Simon Peter. So that's what's next on my.
I definitely look forward to that. Maybe this is a good segue to the next question then. So who's the leader that has inspired you most?
Well, so the obvious answer is Jesus, because everything that I hope to do, I mean, every day my life begins on my knees saying, here I am, I'm yours. Please use me and help me to be the man you want me to be and help me to follow you. And every day I'm reading his story and in the Gospels. And so I would say Jesus head and shoulders above everyone else. But I would say among, you know, more contemporary leaders, I'd have to say Dr. King. And I know a lot of folks would say the same thing, but, you know, his most recently, my small group was reading some of his sermons from Strength to Love. He's We've got one of his associates coming to speak right after on the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's death. Clarence Jones is coming to Resurrection. He was his friend and lawyer and smuggled out the letter from a Birmingham jail when Dr. King was in jail. He wrote the I Have a Dream speech, or at least the first seven. He wrote the speech, and then Dr. King abandoned it after seven paragraphs to tell about the dream that he had. But anyway, so I'd say when I look at Dr. King, there are things about him, of course, that I wouldn't affirm. There are, you know, things he had. He was like all of us. He had clay feet and he didn't get everything right. And he struggled sometimes in certain areas. But the courage to speak up for the people who couldn't speak up for themselves, the courage to call people to love and not hate. And there's just over and over again, there are things about him. I think I hope when I grow up, I get to be more like that.
Yeah, that certainly does seem relevant to what we've been talking about the courage to act in the face of anxiety and division and fear. So yes. Thank you for sharing that. Adam, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us, and thank you for your tremendous ministry, your tremendous work. And I think I'm so so struck as we have this conversation about your constant curiosity and willingness to take on new issues and look at them through the light of faith, and helping us all think through so many of the things that we need to be thinking about. So thank you so much for your work and your ministry, and thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you, Anne. And I want to say to you how much I appreciate the Lewis Center. I appreciate the newsletters that come out. I appreciate the work that you all do in fostering leadership. I think you're one of the best things that's going in the United Methodist Church today on leadership, and I really, really value what you do. So, Anne, thank you again, and thanks for letting me be on your program.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by More Church Leaders, Stronger Church Leaders. This video toolkit teaches you strategies to identify and support new leaders and build and maintain effective ministry teams. More Church Leaders, Stronger Church Leaders is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/shop. Save 25% through June 1st, 2018 with coupon code PODCAST. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Director F. Douglas Poe Jr. speaks with the Reverend Dr. Joshua Mitchell about connecting with millennials.
I think that one of the greatest barriers to change and progress is that we always feel the need to defend, because we love our organizations, we love our church, and we think that they are great, and we pour into them because we think that they are great, and they are. But I think sometimes it takes a bit of discipline to just sit and listen and hear, even when it hurts our feelings, how it is that the millennials see this church, what their challenges are, and where they are asking for us to invest in. So
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.